nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
All right, let's get started then. So again, things are a little bit out of order. Next Wednesday, I'm going to go back and talk a little more simply about a physical argument for why things work the way they do with magnetic fields. But since we're in the middle of the formal solution to the Boltzmann equation, what I'm going to go through today is just the conventional way that people solve the Boltzmann equation when there's a small magnetic field. And we'll just walk through that. It's done in the textbook, so you can follow through it and do it in detail with the textbook. So, more mathematics than physics. Put a B field in there, how do you get an answer? So here's our Boltzmann equation. We can use it in 1D, 2D, 3D. We'll just sum over K states in 1D, 2D, or 3D. We can have any E of K, right? That's no problem. There's no effective mass there. All we need is an E of K. We can have temperature gradients, electric fields. We could have concentration gradients too. And today we want to talk about magnetic fields. All right, let's look at the general solution. So we wrote the Boltzmann equation, and we have this term F sub E. That's the force due to the electric field, is what it has been. And when we solve this Boltzmann equation, we assumed we were near equilibrium. We had this big symmetric part of F that was just like an equilibrium distribution. And then we had this small anti-symmetric part that carried all of the current. And that's the part that we solved for. We invoked this relaxation time approximation. Okay. If we want to solve the Boltzmann equation analytically, we pretty much have to do that. If we want to solve it numerically, we have techniques to do that, and we'll talk a little bit about that later on in the course. And it's steady state, so the time derivative is zero. And in today's lecture, I guess we're going to assume that the concentration gradients are absent. But it just makes the math a little bit simpler. But, you know, when we get all done, all we would have to do is to take gradient of F sub n divided by Q, I guess. So we have gradient of a potential and replace the electric field by that. And then we'd have concentration gradients, right? So the thing we're going to add is we're going to say the force on the electron is not just the force due to the electric field. It's also the force due to a small magnetic field. After the exam, we'll talk more about big magnetic fields a little bit. All right, so the way we're going to solve this standard way that it is usually solved for small magnetic fields is to do it by superposition. You know, the force due to the magnetic field tends to be small. So the electric field is really pushing electrons very strongly. So what we first do is we assume that the magnetic field is zero, and we solve the Boltzmann equation. We've already done that, right? We're going to take the same solution. Then we take that solution, we put it back in the Boltzmann equation, and then we add the magnetic field. And we'll get another component due to that. So we have two components. First one due to the electric field, second one due to the magnetic field, and then we'll add the two. And this will work if the magnetic field is small enough. And we won't be able to figure out what small enough is until after the exam. Okay, but first I want to tell you why we have to do that, or why it's convenient to do it. You don't have to do it, but it's convenient to do it. So let's just say, what if we were solving the Boltzmann equation just with a magnetic field? Right. We could ask, what's the solution to the Boltzmann equation with a magnetic field? So we would have a Boltzmann equation that looks like this. Okay. Now, we would be tempted, when we take this gradient in momentum space, what we'd like to do is to say, we'll take the gradient of the big near equilibrium part that we know, because we know how to do that differentiation. All right, that makes it nice. So let's do that. All right, and the way we like to do that is to use the chain rule. This is a Fermi function. It's something like 1 plus 1 over 1 plus e to the e minus ef over kt. So we first differentiate with respect to energy, and then we differentiate the energy with respect to momentum, and that gives us a velocity. All right, look, all looks reasonable. But now look what happens. Q v cross b dot v is what? Yeah. V cross b is perpendicular to v. So when I dot that into v, I get zero. So if I try to solve the Boltzmann equation this way, I won't get an answer. You know, this approximation here isn't good enough when I'm solving it for a magnetic field. Now, doing it by superposition will get around that difficulty, and there are ways that we can do it for large magnetic fields that get around that. But this is the issue that we have to deal with. This is what prevents us from just solving the Boltzmann equation exactly the same way we did Monday. So we have to be a little bit more careful about that. All right, so the first step in this, we said, is we'll throw the magnetic field out, because the force on an electron due to a magnetic field, unless the B field is really, really strong, that force is usually pretty weak. So I can get most of the answer just with the electric field. So let's do that first. Then we have the standard procedure. We know how to do that. We put the known symmetric part over here on the left-hand side. We take the gradient in momentum space. We apply the chain rule. We do all the stuff that we did on Monday, and we get the same answer that we got on Monday because we threw the magnetic field out. It's the same problem. Okay. Now let's add the magnetic field. And just the magnetic field. Let's try to get the component of F due to the magnetic field. Okay. All right. Well, we've already seen that if we insert the symmetric part here, we're going to get zero. But we've solved for the small anti-symmetric part. Maybe that won't give us zero. All right. So what we're going to do then is to say that the added part due to the magnetic field is going to be related to the perturbation from equilibrium that the electric field gave us. Only that small part is going to give us something. All right. Well, that we know. We just solved that in the previous slide, or we did that on Monday. So what it means is that in order to solve for this added part, the double prime antisymmetric component, we need to take the gradient in momentum space of the FA due to the electric field. All right, so we have to do a little algebra here. All right, and I don't want to do too much because it's not that illuminating. So we're going to solve for this part due to the magnetic field by taking the gradient in momentum space of FA prime. Now, you can apply the chain rule here, right? And the first thing you're going to get, remember, tau might be a function of energy. Scattering time might be energy dependent. So I'm going to take a derivative with respect to energy, and then I'm going to take a dE dP and get a velocity. Okay. If I take a derivative of tau with respect to energy, and then I take a d energy dP, I get a velocity. I get a velocity dot b cross b, I get nothing. Right. The symmetric part is a function of energy, right? If I'm differentiating that with respect to energy, I get another function of energy. If I take the gradient and momentum of that part, I first differentiate with respect to energy and then take a dv dt, and I'll get something with a velocity. I'll get zero again. So if I'm doing my differentiation, this is constant, the second term is constant, and now I have to differentiate v with respect to momentum. That's the only time I'm going to get something different that doesn't have a v out front. Right. So the only thing that we have to do is to, we don't have to worry about differentiating this. That's going to give us a velocity. It'll dot with the v cross b and give us zero. We don't have to differentiate this. That'll give us a velocity, and it'll dot product with v cross b and give us zero. We just have to figure out how to differentiate that thing. And that's the only term that we will get. All right, so how do we do that? It's not so bad. What is the gradient in momentum space? What is V dot E? It's Vx times Ex plus Vy times Ey plus Vz times Ez. That's what we mean by V dot E. So when I take the gradient of that, I'm going to get a vector. The x component of the vector is the derivative of the x part with the unit vector in the x direction. So I have to take ddpx of Vx times the electric field in the x direction plus ddpy times Vy in the Ey direction, y hat, and something in the z component. All right. To keep things simple, let's assume that we have nice spherical energy bands. Velocity is p divided by mass. Velocity in the x direction is px divided by mass. If I take the derivative of px divided by mass, I just get 1 over mass. So each term gives me a 1 over mass. I've got a term in the x direction, the y direction, and the z direction. So this gradient is just 1 over mass times the electric field. Right? Gradient V dot E is a scalar. Gradient of a scalar is a vector. And we just worked it out. What we get is a vector. It's the electric field multiplied by the scalar 1 over effective mass. All right. Just math. We might even. Okay, so we had this extra component to the antisymmetric part of the distribution due to the B field. It was related to the gradient of the perturbation due to the electric field. We just worked out that gradient, and we find that the result is Q tau minus dF dE times E over M. So I can plug that back into FA double prime, and we now have the perturbation due to the magnetic field. Yes?
Mass in X and Y direction might be different. Effective mass either used in the previous slide. It can be different in the different direction.
Yeah, which is why I had spherical bands. You can do it, if you want to do it for anisotropic bands, you could do that. If you want to do it for any E of K, which you can't even describe by an effective mass, you could do that too. You know. So I just did it here to make it look simple. You know, we were differentiating V, and V is dE dK. So we would have the second derivative. We would have d squared e dk squared. We would get.
I would like to ask about the sequence of causes in this system. The electric field is independent, or is it related to the application of the magnetic field? And if the second happens, why should I reassume its existence to calculate the magnetic field?
Because experimentally, the question that we're asking is. We have a simultaneous electric field and magnetic field, right, present. Okay. And we've divided the problem into this two thing, which just looks physically plausible. I don't know if you mathematically. We don't have to do that, and I can show that if a small magnetic field, we'll get this answer. But we just divide it into two parts. We just said most of the effect is going to be due to the electric field because it has a strong force. So we'll do the perturbation for that. And it's similar in philosophy, you know. Similar in philosophy, if we go back here to, when we solved the Boltzmann equation for an electric field, we said, well, on the left-hand side, we can approximate it. We know it's not exact. We can approximate it with a symmetric component. Okay. Now, when we have both a magnetic field and an electric field, we saw that approximation doesn't work. So we have a slightly better approximation. We'll say, well, first we'll get the perturbation due to the electric field, and then we'll put it over here, and we'll find the perturbation due to the magnetic. Now, what I should do then is to take that answer and put it back in here, and I would get an improved answer that would be a little bit better. And then people have an iterative solution. You know, if I did that again, I would get terms proportional to b squared. If I did it again, I'd get terms proportional to b cubed. What we're doing here is we're throwing all of those out. We're only going to get the term proportional to b. All right. So let's see if I can figure out which slide I'm supposed to be on. Is this where we're at?
Yeah.
All right, here's our perturbation. We figured this out. We now have the solution. The solution is V cross B, and then it's dotted in to this derivative that we took, which is in the direction of the electric field, and then here are the constants. Okay. So it's kind of interesting. It goes as tau squared, because when we solved for the electric field part, the perturbation was proportional to tau. When we went back and solved for the perturbation due to the magnetic field, that was also due to tau. So we have a tau squared in the answer instead of a tau. That's going to turn out to be important. All right. This is a scalar triple product. And you might remember that you can switch around the direction between the dot product and the cross product. So you can write this scalar product. It's going to be more convenient for us to write it as V dot B cross E. And there's a vector identity that you might remember that tells us we can do that. All right, so here's what we have. We're near equilibrium, so the distribution function has a big near equilibrium part. We have a small magnetic field, or we have a small electric field. And the magnetic field just exerts a weak force on things. So there's a perturbation due to the electric field that's just what it was before. Then we have a small additional perturbation due to the magnetic field. And the only way that we could get that was to include both terms when we went back and did the derivative. All right. This works for small magnetic fields. If we want to do a little bit better, we would have to continue the process. And here are our two components that we solved for. All right. Any other questions? That's the procedure. Now it's just a matter of working out the results. We've solved the Boltzmann equation. Now we want to compute something that we might measure. So, obvious thing would be to compute the current. And we're going to have two components to the current now. We're going to have a component that comes from the electric field that's going to be identical to what it was before, because the magnetic field is so small it didn't even affect that term. And we're going to have a new component that is solely due to the magnetic field. All right. So, I could, when I get all done doing that, I'm going to have a sigma times electric field, which will be just what it was before. But I'm going to have another sigma, which is going to have a B field in it. Remember I had a V dot B cross E? But I can pull the E outside, and I'm going to get a sigma double prime times E. So my conductivity tensor, which for simple spherical bands was a scalar without the magnetic field, is going to turn out to develop some off-diagonal terms, even though the bands are isotropic and symmetric and spherical. We're going to get a magnetoconductivity tensor that's not diagonal. All right, so the electric field part, okay, we really don't need to go through this. This is what we did on Monday. It's the same. All the answers are the same. Sigma is NQ mu. Mu has this specially defined average characteristic time. We saw how we evaluate that special average. It's the real average of energy times scattering time divided by the average energy. All right, that's what we did before. Everything is the same. Remember, sigma was diagonal for simple bands. So these matrices are, this tensor here is a diagonal tensor, and all the elements are the same. All right, it's the magnetic field one that we have to work on a little bit. So the second term now, after we rearranged that triple product, had a V dot B cross E. Okay, we want to write that this way. We want to write that V dot B cross E is in symbolic notation. We want to write it showing the indices. We want to write it in indicial notation. So we want the ith component of J due to the magnetic field. That's what the double prime means. And that's going to be proportional to a tensor sigma double prime ij times ej, and there's that implied sum. So we have to figure out how to write this expression on the top line in the form of the second line. And to do that, we need to write that cross product in indicial notation. Okay, but we saw how to do that several lectures ago. If I have A cross B in the ith direction, it's epsilon sub ijk times the jth component of A times the kth component of B. And there's an implied sum here. So we sum over j's and we sum over k's. And remember, epsilon had this special property. It was if the subscripts are in the right order, like x, y, z, y, z, x, they're in ascending order, it's plus 1. If they're in the wrong order, like z, y, x, it's minus 1. All right, work it all out, we just get the cross product. It's just a compact way to write a cross product in indicial notation. So we can take this expression in symbolic notation, and we can remember this prescription for doing it in indicial notation. And I can write, let me write the cross product first. So let me write the mth component of the cross product. I have to be careful with my, you know, picking my labels for these things, because when I put it all together, if the label is duplicated, it means I'm doing a sum. I have to be careful, I only sum the things I want to. So let's just say we're trying to find some component of the cross product, the mth component. So it will be epsilon sub m. And then it will be the nth component of the B field times the jth component of the electric field. Right. I label the electric field with J because I know where I'm going. When I get all done, I want something that's like sigma ij times ej. So I can write it like a tensor. All right, so that's just following this prescription here. Now I have to do a dot product. So a dot product, you take the mth component of velocity and you dot it, you multiply it by the mth component of the cross product, which we've just formed. All right, so we have the, this is dot product of V into B cross E. I'm going to sum over J's, I'm going to sum over N's, and I'm going to sum over M's. Right. I should have had a homework problem where you do this. All right, but you keep it all straight, you can do it. Then you stick it back here. And now we've got the current in indicial notation. Complete, everything's in indicial notation. And it just starts to look a little bit ugly. But, you know, that's what our additional component of the magnetoconductivity tensor looks like. So now we have an expression for sigma ij due to the magnetic field. I'm just going to pull the electric field out of this parentheses, and I'm going to define everything else as a B field dependent conductivity tensor. And it is what it is, and this is what it is. So we have to work this thing out, but let's just sort of see what's going to happen without sitting down and slogging all the way through it. The top line is our magnetoconductivity tensor. Okay. Let's look at what happens. Let's look at a diagonal component. You know, we have diagonal components of the tensor. We did those with the electric field. They're n, q, mu, right? We know what they are. Let's look at what the magnetic field does to the diagonal components of the tensor. So I have to put I and j is equal to 1. Okay? So I will be equal to 1. Okay. Now, recall that when we integrate over angle, we'll have these terms, and we're going to have to, when we convert this sum over k space to an integral, we're going to integrate over the polar and azimuthal angles, theta and phi. And recall that when you do that, if you have a Vx, Vy, or a Vy, Vz, all of those by symmetry integrate to zero. Only the Vx squared, or Vy squared, or Vz squared gives you a finite answer. So if we're looking at I is equal to 1, then only M equals 1 is going to give us an answer. All right. So let's see here. When we did my magnetoconductivity tensor, I put I is equal to 1. I put J is equal to 1. So I only have one term of this integral here that's going to, that even has a chance to give me something non-zero, and that's M is equal to 1. So now I have epsilon, that's I use my wrong index there. M. N. M is one. So I have a one. I have a one at the front, and I have a one at the middle, and then I have an N. I have an N in the middle. I've got a typo on there. If you send me an email, you can get extra credit for that. Did everybody see that? You know, the M is a one because that's the only one that when I integrate is going to give me a non-zero term. The J was already one. The N depends on whether I'm looking at BX, BY, or BZ. All right, so I have one N one. What is that? All right, whenever you repeat an index in the alternating unit tensor, you get a zero. So the point is the diagonal components don't change. The magnetic field doesn't do anything to them. Right. That's only to first order. If I did this a little more carefully and carried it out to second order, you would find that the diagonal components are changed. But for small magnetic fields, there's no change. All right. So the only thing that happens, if anything happens, are to the off-diagonal components. So let's see what happens there. I have... Let's try the 1-2 component. I is equal to 1, J is equal to 2. So I put I is equal to 1 over here in V sub I. I put J is equal to 2 over here in epsilon sub M N J. Okay. And boom, boom, boom. Now when I do these sums in epsilon, I have to sum over M 1, 2, 3. And I have to sum over N, 1, 2, 3. But in any of those cases, if I have a 2, I won't get anything because I'll have a repeated index. So the only ones I have to consider are the possibility that M is equal to 3 and N is equal to 1. Then I won't have anything repeating and my epsilon will be minus 1. Oh, 3, 2, 1. Epsilon will be plus 1 because they're in cyclic order. It goes up. If I go 1, 2, and then around again, 3. But if I have M is equal to 3, I have something like a VX, VZ that I'm going to be integrating. That's going to give me 0. Right, so this term will give me 0. What about if I interchange these? What if I make M is equal to 1 and N is equal to 3? Then I'll get an epsilon 1, 3, 2. That's going in the wrong order, so that's a minus 1. But since I made M equal 1, I'll have a V1 times a V1. That's like VX squared. When I integrate VX squared over all angles, I get something. So this term is, there's only one of the terms in these implied sums here that give me anything finite, and it's the V1 squared term. And B3, then, N was equal to 3, that's in the Z direction. So I'm only going to get a sigma 1, 2 if I have a Z-directed magnetic field. And this is the only term that will come out of that sum. All right. This is the way you do it. All right, so we have something like this. And it's beginning to look familiar. It looks sort of like what we had before. You know, when we did these diagonal components, we had sums that looked like this. It had a V-squared. We have a V-squared. We have a B, which is just a scalar. So we can take it out of the sum. That's not going to hurt anything. We have some constants here we can pull out. But instead, when we were doing the diagonal components, we had a tau. And now we have a tau squared. Right. You know, physically, tau enters into mobility. So when the magnetic field pushes things, the velocity that it pushes on depended on the mobility of the tau. The magnetic force depends on V cross B. So the higher the mobility, the higher the carriers are going, the stronger their magnetic force. So there are two reasons that physically that we depend on tau. We get a tau squared there. All right, so the stuff in the shaded area here is what we got without the magnetic field. We're going to get something that looks similar, but it's a little bit different. It's going to have a magnetic field in, and it isn't quite going to have a mu because I'm not going to have a Q average tau over M. I'm going to have a Q average tau squared over M. Right? So you do a little bit of rearranging, and I do that in the textbook, and you can write the result as there's a minus sign there, sigma, something that people call the Hall mobility. The Hall mobility is related to this average tau squared that comes in. It looks like a, it looks sort of like a mobility, but it's a Hall mobility. It's the actual mobility multiplied by a numerical factor. And the numerical factor is just average value of tau f quantity squared divided by the average value of tau f, the whole thing squared. Okay. So if you work through this substitution, look at the book about how you do that. We can do that. We can compute this average if we have power law scattering. And what you'll find is that if you know the characteristic exponent for scattering, you can also work out what this Hall coefficient is. So this is one of the things. People frequently do Hall effect measurements along with resistivity measurements to determine the mobility, but you don't really determine the mobility that you usually want for current flow. The drift mobility is this mu sub n that tells me the carriers move at a velocity mu sub n times the electric field. What you deduce from a Hall effect measurement is that mobility times some numerical factor. The numerical factor depends on the characteristics of the scattering processes. So if you think you know what type of scattering is going on and what kind of energy dependence it has, then you can compute this quantity and you could deduce what the real mobility is. Sometimes that's not so easy to do. Sometimes people also use Hall effect measurements to measure the carrier density. You have the same uncertainty in the carrier density. This Hall factor comes in. It might be between 1 and 2. So you have that kind of uncertainty in the Hall effect measurement. So here's our final result. If I go through all the off-diagonal terms, you know, each one will have an expression that looks like that one in particular that I looked at. It'll involve this epsilon because it's fundamentally it's coming from this cross product, the magnetic force QV cross B. If you work that all out, your magnetoconductivity tensor will look something like this. So this is a simple spherical band with a small magnetic field. To first order in magnetic field, the diagonal components are just sigma naught. Nothing has changed. But we get these distinct off-diagonal contributions, and this is what gives us Hall effect, things like that. Okay. So if I write the current as sigma ij times E sub j, I'll get a current expression that looks like this. And the current expression is, you know, nice. We'll see after the exam that you can actually derive this with simple arguments pretty easily, and you can see physically where it comes from. The only thing that it doesn't tell you is how to do that average, that Hall. You know, if you need to know how to compute that average Hall factor, it doesn't tell you how to do that. All right, so you've seen how to do it. So you should go through the reading in the book and see how all of those steps work out. But remember, we have these coupled current equations that we can either derive from the Boltzmann equation or we can rearrange into the form that experimentalists like to work with. And it shouldn't be a surprise that every one of these parameters, the resistivity, the Seebeck coefficient, the Peltier coefficient, and electronic heat conduction, every one is going to be a B-field dependent tensor and will be have off-diagonal contributions when you apply a magnetic field. So everyone becomes B-field dependent. You can work everyone out just the way we worked out the conductivity, and you'll get answers that are similar. So let's not go through it in great detail. Everyone is going to look sort of like this. It's going to have a diagonal component, plus it's going to have off-diagonal components that look like cross products because they're coming from this magnetic force, QV cross B. So there will be some, you know, for the resistivity, I'm showing explicitly what that is. There will be some collection of constants times epsilon ijkbk for Seebeck coefficient. There will be some collection of constants for Peltier and some for electronic heat conduction. They'll all have a similar form. And if you have ellipsoidal bands, or if you have non-parabolic bands, or if you have much more complicated band structures, things will get more involved. And if you want to see some expressions for what they look like more generally with semiconductors that have less symmetry, you can look at this book. People used to do a lot of measurements. You know, it wasn't clear, first of all, that silicon had ellipsoidal constant energy surfaces, or whether they were located along 100 directions or 111 or where. People didn't know that in the early 60s. A lot of what they did was to do measurements like this and try to determine where are the off-zero elements, where are the non-zero elements in these various tensors. And you can then deduce something about the symmetry of the crystal and where the energy minimum are if you measure those tensors and figure out which ones are off zero, are non-zero. All right, we'll go through a real quick example just to see how you might use it. You know, when you get all done, how do you use these? So let's look at the Seebeck coefficient. Let's say we want to measure the Seebeck coefficient in the presence of a magnetic field. All right, so let's apply a magnetic field in the z direction. And let's say that I have the right side hotter than the left side. I put a high impedance voltmeter and I want to measure the voltage. So I'm going to measure the Seebeck coefficient. Let's say this semiconductor is sitting on a nice solid heat sink, so there are no temperature gradients in the Y direction, but I can force a temperature gradient in the X direction. All right. That might be a little challenging to do. So we'll work it out another way, because it's not obvious how we make a heat sink that will make the temperature uniform in the Y direction and not uniform in the X direction. Right. But let's assume that and see what we get. Well, we have our equations, right? And we could work out expressions for each one of those, but we know that they're going to look like this. We're going to be measuring the electric field in the x direction, or the potential drop in the x direction. So we're going to be dealing with E sub x and ask what that is. We're going to do it under open circuit conditions, because that's the way we did the experiment. No current is flowing. It's a high impedance voltmeter. So J is zero in Jx, Jy, Jz. So the electric field in the x direction is going to be only the diagonal component of the Seebeck coefficient times the gradient of the temperature in the x direction, because I've assumed there are no gradients in the other direction. All right. So I know that my Seebeck coefficient has a diagonal part, and then it has another part that looks like epsilon ijk times b sub k. And I have to decide whether that extra part due to the B field is going to give me anything in this measurement. Right. Well, the only component that I'm going to be measuring is SS sub XX. So X, it'll be epsilon sub X. J is also X. Epsilon sub XX in the B field is in the Z direction. Epsilon sub XXZ is zero. So I'll measure exactly what I want to measure. Right, the B field won't affect it. All right, that's nice. So the B field has no effect to first order. All right, but what if I say that, well, I really don't, I'm not sure how to maintain the temperature constant in the Y direction while I'm putting a temperature gradient in the X direction. That might be a little tough to do. But maybe I could maintain that there's no heat flow in the Y direction. I could put some thermal insulators around the edges so that the heat can't flow in the Y direction, but we'll put a temperature gradient so the heat can flow in the x direction. That might be an easier experimental condition to apply. So we'll call that adiabatic in the y direction. That might be an easier experiment to do. So if I've done that, and I ask what's the electric field, it's going to be S sub ij times the gradient in the of temperature. I is x, so I could have gradients in the x, y, and z direction. Okay, well, I'm assuming nothing in the z direction. Let's assume that that doesn't exist. There is one in the x direction because that's an experiment. I've got a temperature difference across it. I know what the form of this tensor is. They all look the same. They have that cross product. So it has a diagonal component, so I'm going to get an S0 times the gradient of temperature in the x direction. And then it has this off-diagonal component. So epsilon, I'm I have S sub 1. I have a B field in the Z direction, so K is Z. I have XJ. What do I have here? I'm looking in the, I is in the X direction because I'm looking for the X-directed electric field. So I is X. So I is X, K is Z because the B field is in the Z direction. The only possibility is that J has to be Y, or I'll, to get a non-zero term. So if J is Y, it means there's a temperature gradient in the Y direction. That might exist. We've enforced zero heat flow in the Y direction. There might be a temperature gradient in the Y direction. So if there is, I will get some added contribution to the electric field. So how do I decide if there is? I go to the second equation. Experimentally, I'm enforcing zero heat flow. It's open circuited, so there's no current flow. So I can forget about the first term. So I have zero is equal to minus electronic heat conduction. We've enforced zero in the Y direction, so I is Y. And then I look at the gradients in the other directions. The form of the electronic heat conduction, it has exactly the same form as all the other tensors. Okay. So we say zero. The first term is diagonal. It's the electronic heat conduction, the diagonal component, times the Y direction of the Y derivative of the electric field. So that's K sub YY dy dt dy. But then I've got a second term here. And that second term, I is in the Y direction. The B field is in the Z direction. The only possibility to get a non-zero term is to let J be in the X direction. That would imply a temperature gradient in the X direction. And I know that there is a temperature gradient in the X direction. So I've forced a temperature gradient in the X direction. I've applied a magnetic field in the Z direction. Epsilon sub YXZ is non-zero. So this term is going to be non-zero. The sum of these two terms equals zero. So I can solve for the unknown gradient in the Y direction. I can plug that back in the electric field expression. And if I go in the lab and do this experiment, I'm going to find that the electric field in the X direction, due to a temperature gradient in the X direction, depends on the magnetic field in the Z direction. All right. So I would not be measuring the Seebeck coefficient. I would be measuring the Seebeck. If I had been interested in the question, is the diagonal component of the Seebeck coefficient B field dependent, I wouldn't have the answer to my question, because the quantity that I've measured experimentally is B field dependent, but it's a combination of off diagonal terms. So this is an example. You know, this is how experimentalists use these equations. You have an experiment. You try to deduce what your experimental conditions are. You try to understand what the form of your transport tensors are, and they've all been worked out long ago. You can look up Smith, Janik, and Adler and look in the appendix if you know what kind of crystal you're working with. And then you can decide what your experiment is really measuring, and whether you've controlled what you need to control. In this case, you would be measuring an apparent Seebeck coefficient, but you'd want to know that it's not the real Seebeck coefficient. Okay, so you can see more about that in the book. All right, now, if you want to test your understanding of this, you can solve a problem that I don't know the answer to yet. The first part, I gave this very clear, well, as clear as I could make it today, step-by-step procedure for solving the Boltzmann equation with a B field. I sort of implied that it works for any E of K. Try it for graphene and see if it works. I haven't worked it out in detail, but I think there may be a problem. It would be worth having a look at. We might learn something. And if I learn something, I'll talk about it next week. But that would be worth thinking about. Okay, so there are a few loose ends that I want to tie up after the exam. And it mainly has to do with looking a little more at stronger magnetic fields. And also, I was just at a meeting where somebody called me a B-field bigot, because I said, you know, I'm a device engineer. We don't like to work with B fields. It's hard to make useful devices out of them. And, you know, but people use them for, first of all, you can have permanent magnets that get you reasonably high magnetic fields. So maybe you can use them. But they're also they're used widely for characterization. And there are things like Shubnikov-Dehaas oscillations and quantum Hall effect that it's probably worth being aware of because you see it so commonly that people use it. So I'll see if I can talk about those two topics, and that means that we're not going to be talking about percolation theory, which is okay because Professor Alam has a set of lectures that are just coming up in the Nano Hub, and he can do it better than I can anyway. All right, so that's it.